Are you on dope?
Yes.
What kind?
Musical dope.
You get high?
Yes.
Off of what?
Music.
Are you on a trip or something?
Yes.
What kind of a trip?
Music.
How old are you?
I'm old in mind, but young in age.
Hey, this is Brianna Marie, and you're listening to the art of vocal and instrumental sound combined to produce harmony and emotion on Soul Discovery.
This is Soul Discovery. Soul Discovery.
Such a hold that you got on me. Mr. Ron Matlock, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Ron, it's been a long time.
Well, yeah, it's been a long time, but as you mentioned before, we did talk before, and you mentioned that I basically sound the same, and that's because even as we age, we stay pretty much the same age within, and that's just how things go. And that's how I feel. I feel like this is still sort of 1978, even though 30 years have passed.
Let's get straight to the cuts. Vocalist, you're fantastic. A writer, no one can compare to some of the lyrics that you've put down on paper. How did this all start?
This all started, actually, it all started with a lie. I grew up near Hitchville, USA. Didn't know what it was when I passed by it when I was in the car with my parents. But I'd noticed that people were standing outside of it during summer and even winter. They'd just be standing outside this building. And so I took it on myself one day to take the public transportation up to there and to go inside and ask what they did. And when I found out what was going on, actually, as soon as I approached the place, I noticed three girls standing out front, and it was Diana Ross and the Supremes. And they were quite young at the time, and I was quite young at the time, and I kind of approached them just to ask who I should see about finding out more about this establishment. And they pointed me to a building that was next door to Hitchville. And I went inside, and I met Barry Gordy's sister, Esther Edwards. And she asked me, you know, what I wanted there, and she kind of gave me clues as to what I should say, like she had done this so many times with other people who approached. And so I had brought a magazine from L.A., and I just, off the top of my head, I was nervous, like you say, that we're nervous now. I just told her that I wrote for this magazine. I had noticed that in that magazine they had no interviews with Motown people. And so I told her I wrote for that magazine and I wanted to interview some acts. And she asked, well, who do you want to interview? I mean, it was just as straightforward as that. And I said, Stevie Wonder, who at the time, that was my idol, still is. And she said, sorry, but Stevie's actually in Great Britain right now on tour. And I'm like, oh, this is great. I'd come all this way, and it wasn't that far, but I wasn't used to going anywhere on public transportation at the time. And I've come all this way, he's not here. And so she said, well, would you like to interview the Supremes? They're right out there. And I'm like, oh, sure. So that was the first interview, and I guess I went on to interview probably everybody at Motown. At the same time, that night when I went home with my notes and whatnot, where she supplied me with pen and paper as well, I jotted off a letter to this magazine in Los Angeles, and told them that I can get you interviews with anyone at all at Motown. And so they signed me up and gave me a salary and the whole bit. And that's how it started.
And that was all through a little white lie. How fantastic.
From a little white lie.
Yeah.
And actually, I'll go on just for a second. During one of the interviews, it was my first interview with the Temptations. We were in a basement beneath the Hitchville, USA building that was where a rehearsal studio was. Norman Whitfield was in the basement with the Temptations, at least four of them. David, ever the testy sort, was outside with some girls. We were in the basement, and they had a rehearsal. David was upstairs. He didn't care. And that's my take on it, but that's the way it looked to me. And they made excuses for it, but it just seemed like when I tried to talk to him, he didn't care one way or the other, whether he was interviewed or whether he rehearsed. He was there, and that was it. But there was a song that they did Norman wrote for them. Whether he wrote it for them, I have no idea. But he, at that time, wrote it, and it was called, I think it was The End of Our Road.
Oh,
right. And The Temptations did it first.
Yeah, yeah. And
whether it was on an album or not, I have no idea. But that gave me the bug, and that's when I started writing.
And did you become like an apprentice underneath Norman Whitfield?
Yes. Initially, I just became a pest. I was there all the time to see how it was that he did what he did. It seemed so easy at first, but when I went home, I didn't have any music. He had music without singing that Eddie Holland had done on a tape, and or that he had done actually on a tape. And he and Eddie Holland wrote the lyrics, but the way that he did it. It seemed so fluid and so flawless. He was just like, he spotted the lyric, Eddie Kendricks wrote them down, and I was in awe of this process. I tried it at home, and what I did was take a Norman Whitfield composition on The Temptations, Ain't Too Proud to Beg, and I wrote a song called It's Too Late for Tears, which is a total nothing. It was nothing, but Norman was impressed. He said, you listened to Ain't Too Proud to Beg, pushed away the melody and the lyric to that and in your mind, and wrote this whole new melody and lyric to this song. And I wish I had a tape of that, but it was never recorded. But he told me that I should, he said, you should try to do this. And so I did. I kept at it and kept at it. And my first recording at Motown was Out in the Country by Bobby Taylor, who had recently left the Vancouvers.
Where there's a
So with Motown, how long were you there for?
At Motown, I was there for years, probably from around 1964 until, in the 70s, into the 70s, probably 75 or 76. During that time, Hank Cosby, the great Hank Cosby, was the musical director there and a record producer. And he approached me twice to offer me a songwriter's contract. The first time I was all for it. I went home and my mother had to sign it because I was underage. And she refused the first time. And so I went back with that and told him I couldn't do it. And then years later he offered another. And neither one was paying me what I thought that I should be paid. I wasn't looking for a lot of money. Actually, I was only looking for maybe $50 more than he was offering. But I didn't have enough savvy to tell him that, you know, offer me $50 more, I'll sign. But I never did. And he seemed impressed as well as kind of upset that I didn't sign that second time. At that time, Motown was about to... Well, Motown actually left Detroit for the most part and went to L.A. Mm-hmm. And he wanted to sign me, wanted me to come to L.A. And I wasn't all for that as well. And once they left, I then went over and started doing the same thing that I did at Motown with Invictus Records, which was... owned and operated by Holland Dozier Holland.
Yeah, you actually followed them over then with the likes of Glass and, House and Laura Lee, yeah?
Laura Lee, yeah. And strange you mentioned Laura Lee. Angela Bond, writer over there, that we, I guess, were right around in the same boat. I'm not sure if Angela signed a contract there or not. I didn't. I was in the mood of not signing contracts, and I just did. I wouldn't. So I didn't sign a contract there as well. And Angela was talking to me one day. I was writing a song, probably for the Honeycomb, and it was never recorded. But it had something to do with women's liberation.
Right. Okay.
And Angelo knew I was writing it, and he came up to me and he asked me what I thought about it. And he asked me pointed questions, and I gave him my answers as I'm trying to write this song. And I told him I'm writing this song about it. And within a week, Stand Up and Fight for Your Love Rights was out, and half of the things that he talked to me about were on that. And so I jokingly went up to him. I told him I deserve a writer's credit for that, Angelo, because you got most of that from me. And he laughed about it. We laughed because that's the way it is. You know, if you're going to write songs in an atmosphere where there are nothing but writers around, you keep your lyrics and whatnot close to your vest. And I was never that way. I'd tell you what I was doing because nobody did things exactly the way that I did it. So I didn't feel any trepidation about letting you know what I was doing. But with Angelo, he got me that time. And but there's no hard feelings about that. And so consequently, I ended up not writing anything for that company. I wrote things for them, but nothing was ever released.
Moving on from Invictus, when you never got the contract, was that the time you met up with the likes of Eddie Kendricks and Michael Stokes?
I had met Eddie years before, of course, when I was interviewing. And I also, around the time I met Michael, I met Eddie's brother, Clarence Kendricks. Mm. And Clarence was actually a janitor at Motown. And at the time, we could, it's going to sound incongruous to you, but at the time at Motown, even though I wasn't under contract, I was part of the family. And at Motown, any of the LPs that came out, you could buy, if you were part of the family, you could buy up to 10 of them for $1 each.
Wow.
And, of course, I had the whole catalog because I'd buy everything. Well, Clarence had a record store that he was starting, and so he approached me, and he said, I need a couple of copies of this and a couple of copies of that for the store. I'm buying things through the one-stops, the distributors, but I need a couple of these because they're out of them. And I'd buy them, and he paid me back. And so I looked at the record store, the operation of it, and I'd give him pointers on what I'd do if I were in there. And he offered me a job. He said, well, you know, you're writing all the time. That's basically all you're doing. Can you help me out in the shop? So I was there. Well, next door, Eddie Kendricks, his brother, had opened an office for his company, EJK Records. In that office, he had a few people. He had a group that was called Posse. There were five young men that were kind of tall and pretty much clones of the Temptations. But, of course, they didn't sound like the Temptations. But they did have one standout singer that sounded a lot like Eddie, but he sounded a lot like the guy that sang in the Delphonics as well. And his name was Ricky Langston. He's passed on now, but he was a great singer. And I listened, and I said, I'd love to write some songs for these guys. And Eddie said, great. And his brother-in-law, Eddie's wife's brother, was Michael Stokes. And he was in from New York. And he and I got together and wrote a couple of things, played around with him. And then I ended up going out on the road so that we could meet Michael in New York and write. I went on the road with the Temptations. And which was, that was a thrill, just to be out on the road with them for years. I went out for a few years and was at so many of their shows as they toured. We wrote here in Detroit, but we wrote also out on the road. And some of the songs that we wrote for Posse, we wrote on the road. And Michael and I developed an affinity to working with one another. Eddie was a writer, but Eddie was busy being a Temptation. So he had a lot more time on his hands than we did. We took our time and wrote songs. And we felt each other out until we figured out that, okay, even though I can write music, lyric and melody are my strong suits. And even though Michael could write lyric and melody, writing composition, the tracks, was his strong suit. So we gravitated toward those, and that's where we left it. We would do that, and neither of us stepped on one another's toes. So whenever there's a composition by the two of us, you know that Michael has written the music, I've written the lyric and the melody.
Okay, and was this the first project that you worked on together? Was the Love City for yourself? Or was there other material that never came out?
Oh, well, we worked on the Posse material.
Yeah, yeah.
And we did songs with them. But when we got together as a definite songwriting partnership, my project was not the first. We got together, we split apart for a while. Nothing antagonistic about that. It's just that Mike went back to New York before he finally moved here. And he approached me a few years later and said that he was doing a project on Shirley Caesar. And they had written some songs, but they were running into a snag. And they needed me because, well, my really my long suit is, if you've got a song, the music sounds okay. And what you need is to make sure that the lyric and the composition and the melody sound okay. You need somebody like me who can take what you have and dress it up and actually have it sounding, I guess, the way that it should. And at the time, a person like me, they called us song doctors. If you had a song and it needed fixing, you came to somebody like me who would listen to it and put things right. And that's what I did with two songs on that Shirley Caesar project, which were all also written with EJ Emmanuel Johnson from Enchantment.
Mm.
And that was on that project. On the next Shirley Caesar project, I think I wrote 5 songs with Mike, and those were just me and Mike. And both those LPs they went gold. And after that, we did of course the Keith Barrow project, including You Know You Want to Be Loved.
Nobody has to tell me just like this. gonna be loved just like this. Oh, baby,
just like this.
So good inside.
Just like this.
You know,
you know you want to be loved.
You know,
you know you want to be loved.
Oh,
just like this.
Nobody has to tell.
Just like this.
Were you thinking, because you hadn't put vocals down yourself at the time, were you thinking of then recording for yourself?
Well, here's the rub. Whenever, like I say, I do lyrics and melodies, so that lets you know that I'm the one that the singer learns to sing the song from.
Hmm.
And that means that I put down the track before they even hear it. So everything that I write, I always do the track first.
Yeah, yeah.
So the tracks are out there. Whether you'll ever hear them, that's going to be up to Michael. Because he's the one that owns those tracks. And although I'm singing on all of the Shirley Caesar and all of the Keith Barrow things, and even on my stuff, there are outtakes and there are alternate tracks that he owns, and he'd have to give the okay on that. And I don't know if they've been approaching him, and I haven't talked to Mike in a number of years. So I don't know what he plans to do with that. I know that I've been approached by Warner Brothers about alternate tracks and the like. And actually, they wanted to hear me doing You Know You Want to Be Loved and a couple of the others. And I told them the tracks are there, but you have to speak to Michael. And I haven't heard anything else from it. So whether Michael is averse to doing that, I have no idea. I haven't spoken to him.
Love City album, my favourite track on this album. It's in my all time top five easy. Take Me to the Top of Your Mountain. When I first heard that in 1978 on a local radio station in London, it just totally blew me, because soul had gone to another level. While it was all disco going round and people were dancing on the dance floor, you were true. Your album at that time, it stuck to its roots, and that track said it all to me. Why did you put that sort of lyrics and that sort of song down at that time? Surely at the time you knew that it was not the right time at the time. If you know what I'm saying. I'm confusing myself.
No, I understand totally. Well, here's one thing that you have to know, is that I, who had been a bachelor for years, I had played the field. I had fallen in love with my soon-to-be wife. And of course, like all couples, we had issues that we talked about, even argued about. And one of the things that we talked about was that she would not open up to me as well as I'd open up to her. Not true. I'm a lyricist, and I have a way with words when I really want to use them. And she's not that sort. And she would clam up about certain things, and I'd ask pretty pointed questions at times, and she'd just say that she wouldn't want to talk about it. And so I gained knowledge over asking questions that she didn't, that she had been hurt before. So this song came across my desk, so to speak. And actually Michael, he was just singing right on top of it, Take Me to the Top of Your Mountain, over and over. And so I listened to that while I was thinking about her and wrote this song about it and asked her to, you know, just give me a chance. And so it evidently it worked, because she, not long after that, agreed to become my wife.
Take
great. Next time I get in trouble or anything with my wife, I'm going to call you so you can talk to her directly.
Glad to be of service.
Right, and one other thing I've got to mention. A guy in the UK, Steve Dowland, actually walked down the aisle to one of your songs, You've Got the Best of Me. He never had the Wedding March. They had that as their jingle, their song going down the aisle. So it just shows you.
Priceless.
Yeah, it's just amazing. So we mentioned Steve anyway. Hope he's listening. He'll be all embarrassed now.
Great. So great. I hope that marriage is doing well.
It's doing very well. Now, yes, because of your lyrics. Now, we think, we're not sure, that the Love City album is going to be reissued, what are we saying, the back end of August, are we?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Okay. What's the future for you, Ron?
At this point, I developed a MySpace page and went out and touched some of the people that I've worked with over the years through that, who had no idea how to contact me. Now I'm getting a lot of recontacts. I'm getting together with a lot of the people that I worked with at Motown or at Invictus or at Sound Suite Studios, where I did my album and the Keith Barrow and some of the other stuff. And I did a project some years ago on Millie Scott.
Mm, yes, fantastic. Yeah.
Song in particular, the big one was Every Little Bit. Don't You Ever Stop, I Want Every Little Bit of You. And I worked on that with a guy named Bruce Nazarian. We had a great time together. And we kind of lost touch. And I found him on MySpace, and it's like old home. Oh, yeah, we talk every day. And he wants me to come out, too. He's got offices and studios in L.A. and in Las Vegas. And he wants me to come out. I may or I may not. What we're going to do, what we did settle on, is that in this electronic age, he's going to send me tracks. And I'm going to write songs to them. And we'll see what we have. If we still got that magic, then I'll be on my way to L.A. or Las Vegas, or probably both. And we'll do some projects on other people, including Bruce. Bruce is a guitarist. He used to be with a rock band called Brownsville Station. Smoking in the Boys Room was their big hit back in the day. And also, there's talk of doing stuff on me. And Bruce is a wonderful producer. I'm a producer, and I'm sure that between the two of us, we'll have some great songs and probably some great production.
Before we go, Ron, I would like to know, how's your health?
Well, and my health is, at this point, it's great. It's nearly 100%. I have had some problems. I was a diabetic for years. And through that diabetes, I developed some heart problems, and I ended up having a bypass operation in 2002. Then I sprung back. My health seemed fine, but it was misleading. I began getting weaker and found that my kidneys were failing. But I lost the use of my kidneys and was on dialysis for 2 years. Well, on May 23rd this year, I received a new kidney transplant. And I'm doing great. I don't know how to tell anyone. But if you're having a problem with your kidneys, and they and doctors, if they give you an idea that you need to go on to dialysis, don't be afraid. Do it and get on the kidney recipient list. And with a new kidney, you will feel like you did when you were 17. Take it from me. It's true.
That's absolutely fantastic. I'm really pleased that you're on the mend, and hope you go from strength to strength. And looking forward to the new material. But first off, we've got the album coming back out again, which I think will be a big seller because, as you know, your album is very collectible across Europe and Japan. But is there a site that we can touch base with you if listeners out there want to get hold of you?
Well, on MySpace,
yeah,
you can touch base with me. And that is Well, it's a MySpace address. I've forgotten how the beginning of it goes, but the end of it is Ron Matlock USA.
Okay, if there's any...
So go to MySpace, you can contact me from there.
Yeah, and if there's any problems with that, you can email me at soul@209radio.co.uk, yes, and I can put you onto that address. Okay, is that all right with you, Ron?
That's good. Okay. And I actually joined the forums on your site.
Yes.
And I actually put on an email address there where I can be contacted. And one thing that you mentioned is that perhaps when this album comes out, it'll be a big seller. I hope so, because I've never been across the ocean, and I'd love to come to England and perform.
That'd be fantastic. God, that'd be absolutely fantastic, that would. Ron Matlock on British soil, singing those fantastic vocals with those lovely lyrics. I think you'll melt a few hearts when you do come over.
Well, that would be okay. I wouldn't mind doing that, because I'm a single man again.
Right, okay. Right, Ron Matlock, thank you very much for your time, and it's great hearing from you, and you take care.
Okay, Mick, anytime.
What you thinking? Even the blind can see that you're mine, and I'm into you, honey. I've been dreaming about this moment all day. Now you seem a million miles away, and I don't know what to do to get my point across to you. You got the best of me. Why don't you come on and take the rest of my love? And maybe then you will feel this time love is real. You got the best of me. Yeah.